Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be catching up on all the security news of the last few weeks in just a moment with our good friend Adam Boileau. And then we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor, Nucleus Security. These are the guys who make software that can connect up all of your vulnerability scanners, sort of glue them together, whether it's, you know, Tenable, Qualys, Snyk, NetSparker, whatever. They'll handle the plumbing. Nucleus co-founder Scott Kufer joins the show this week to talk about how they've discovered a lot of enterprises are actually trying to develop similar software in-house, and it's not going well. Let's just say that. That is coming up later, but first up, let's dive into the news with Adam Boileau. And mate, a bit of ransomware when we had our old break, including a really serious attack against a hospital chain in the United States, Universal Health Services.
Yeah, apparently they control something like 400 hospitals across the US, Puerto Rico, UK, and they're reduced to pen and paper, which, I mean, would be bad any time, obviously during a pandemic, even worse. But yeah, there's just, you know, there's been a whole, you know, raft of ransomware going on, but this kind of, you know, especially in the medical industry in the middle of this, has really captured people's, you know, imagination through the headlines. We also saw that story about a person dying in Germany as a result of being sent to another hospital because the hospital they were going to in an ambulance, you know, had been affected by ransomware. And, you know, those two stories combined are pretty compelling for people and, you know, does underscore really what a problem ransomware has become.
Yeah, there were some rumors going around that the UHS attack had resulted in some fatalities, but I think they were debunked. But I mean, it's hardly the point, is it? Bobby Chesney and I did a podcast some time ago where we spoke about the concept of releasing the hounds against these crews. And, you know, these types of incidents that we're talking about right here, it sort of feels a little bit close to the scenario that we dreamed up that would justify sending agencies like Cyber Command and CIA after ransomware crews, like sort of treat them more like, and I'm going to be careful with this analogy here, but a little bit more like some of these non-state terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, as in give them a type of designation that allows those types of agencies to go after them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, whatever framework they come up with to kind of make it okay, it does seem intolerable, right, to have hospitals shut down by whoever they are, whether it's, you know, on behalf of a nation state or whether it's criminals or some other actor. And, you know, I'm sure the comparisons with the war on terror, of course, are kind of problematic just because that whole thing was, you know, it still a bit of a disaster. But
you see what I mean? You see where I was bringing that into it, right? Which is like, these aren't ordinary criminals, right? Like, in my view, this rises to the level of being a national security threat. And just because the people with the fingers on the keyboards don't work for governments, you know, I don't think that's a reason to exclude the involvement of some of these military and intelligence agencies.
Yeah, and certainly they're better equipped to handle it when we've got, you know, than, say, traditional law enforcement. I mean, the universal healthcare one is said to be Ryuk, which was originally attributed to North Korea, but now looks like it's more, you know, Russian cyber criminal seems to be the general, you know, kind of consensus about attribution. But yeah, traditional law enforcement approaches there are difficult, right, because Russia. And it's not like you can go, you know, put a warhead through, you know, someone's flat in St. Petersburg, right? That's also problematic. So, you know, there are other options.
Well, putting a warhead, you know, through someone's window for ransomware anywhere in the world, I think, is a little bit problematic, Adam.
You know? Yes, but, you know, I mean, perhaps more so in Russia than, you know, somewhere else in the world.
These guys aren't operating from mountainous regions in Pakistan.
Exactly. You can do that kind of thing.
And perhaps that's problematic as well. But anyway, that's a whole other.
Oh, geez, yes.
That's a whole other conversation. We should just stop this line. But can you imagine the global war on ransomware operators? That would be a shorter war than the global war on terror.
yes, it would. And I may actually achieve more. I don't know.
Look. With that in mind, something funny has been happening with TrickBot. The operators of TrickBot are having a hard time. Now, when I read this, there was just something that suggested to me, something in my gut that said, when you read this story, and we've got a Krebs write-up on it, it feels like the people giving them a hard time might kind of wear government ID badges to work in the morning. What did you think of this, Adam? First of all, walk us through the story and then we'll get onto the speculation bit.
Yeah, so TrickBot is a, you know, large botnet of compromised computers that's been used for all sorts of things, you know, stealing people's data and as a drop-off point for other sorts of malware. It's the, you know, the sort of thing where you can go and buy access to, you know, two of the compromised machines to use for whatever you want, plus the usual sorts of spamming and things. And there's been some attribution that the TrickBot network which is what, in the order of a couple of million machines, has been used by some of the ransomware crews. The Ryuk crew in particular appear to have some ties to this particular thing. So botnet runs, you know, people have obviously gone after bugs in botnet, you know, command and control systems, or gone after the individual C2 boxes, or, you know, attack whatever other mechanisms make sense to go and disrupt it. And in this particular case, the config mechanism for TrickBot has been attacked to push out a config that has a bad, you know, command and control IP address. It sets the C2 IP to 127.0.1 localhost, so it can't actually connect. And then simultaneously, there was an attack on a bunch of the malware command and control servers, and they were flooding, whoever's doing this was also kind of generating fake deployments of the malware in the order of millions and millions and millions of boxes, that's then going to confuse the operator as to which machines are real, which ones are fake, and just generally kind of make operating this botnet in the real world right now really, really difficult, which is an interesting kind of, you know, confluence of things all happening at once.
Yeah, well, this actually predates the attack against UHS by a few days, as best I can tell. So I don't think there's a cause and effect here, but there's just something about the trouble that TrickBot is having right now that looks like it came off a whiteboard at Cyber Command. You know, I mean, and look, I've got no information to suggest that that's what this is. I guess maybe I'm just hoping that's what it is, that finally, you know, they're actually going to get the courage to start going after these crews, because this is the sort of thing that should be done to them. Like, why make it easy?
Well, exactly right. And, you know, we've seen attempts to disrupt botnets in the past, you know, by, you know, law enforcement, by various vendors. You know, Microsoft, you know, has done a bunch of botnet takes down over the years. We've also seen, you know, kind of private organizations like Shadow Server, you know, kind of working to disrupt stuff. But, you know, each of those has their own kind of, you know,
vibe, right?
Of, you know, modus operandi, things that make it look like a particular thing. And this doesn't really look like.
No, it's got a real Govy vibe. Now, look, I mean, it could be some, you know, threat intel person who's just doing this for shiggles. Yeah. Like, it absolutely could, but there is just something about it that just feels a little bit like it could be some sort of operation, right? And you would hope that they're not going to end it here, that they're going to, you know, push onwards. Because, I mean, look, you know, the story here by Krebs, it suggests that it, you know, maybe it's a rival crew. But as best I can tell, most of the crews who play in this space actually get along okay. So, you know, I mean, it's a whodunit, Adam. It's a whodunit.
Yeah, and you know, the great thing about the internet is absolutely it could just be one guy. You know, the 400-pound hacker in his basement kind of thing. Absolutely could be that. But, you know, who really knows? And maybe we'll find out. Maybe we'll see where this heads. You know, maybe it'll go quiet and we won't hear anything more of it. Maybe this is part of a bigger operation and we're only seeing, you know, a couple of the pieces of the puzzle and it will become clear.
Yeah. Wait and see for sure. It's funny when you find out stuff, isn't it, eventually? Like, if you do. We might not. So, yes, just purely just throw that all in the speculation bucket, everyone. I'm not saying that, you know, this was a US government op. I'm just saying that you read that and you think, basically. And it was funny too, because I read it and I sent it to you and I'm like, are you thinking what I'm thinking sort of thing? And yes, you were thinking.
Yeah, I'm thinking what you're thinking.
All right. Now, Microsoft released its security intelligence report, and Catalin Kimpanu over at ZDNet has done an excellent job summarizing it. And he pulled out one stat as the lead, which is that some ransomware attacks take less than 45 minutes. And this is like, he's not talking about you know, just one single endpoint attack here. They're saying from infected endpoint, you know, to complete domain compromise and ransomware in 45 minutes. I'm impressed. It's like that thing from Anchorman, right? Like, I'm not even mad. I'm, you know, that's amazing.
Well, I mean, it certainly makes sense. Like, once you're in there, you know, if you've got the straightforward privacy to the domain admin, you may as well make hay, you know, while the sun's shining. But there's yeah, Catalin's write-up of this report's pretty good. It's quite a, you know, quite a read, something like 80-whatever pages of stuff. And there's a few things to pull out. You know, one was that there was kind of overall less COVID-themed everything than perhaps people were predicting at the beginning of the year. So that's nice, I guess. Also a write-up of, you know, some of the ways that, you know, the different sets of attackers, you know, different sorts of ways that they're moving through people's networks, different tooling. So all that kind of useful stuff that probably if you're in the threat intel business, you already are kind of familiar with what's going on, but it's kind of good overall context for people. And Microsoft has such good visibility, you know, over such a wide range of enterprise networks. And you can really see the the benefit that this is making for some of their detective tools, you know, because of the visibility that they've got. So yeah, it's just kind of really good situational awareness for what's actually going on, you know, in, you know, quite a wide swathe of places.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine the telemetry they have is quite a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I wish I had some of that, you know, fire hose on tap.
Yeah. What else have we got here? The US Treasury. Okay, so Garmin got itself ransomware a little while back. What was that? July, August, sometime yeah. around there. And they paid. And it looked like they paid a whole bunch of cryptocurrency to a whole bunch of Russians who are actually on Treasury sanctions lists. And we were saying, like, well, you know, maybe they're going to get in trouble over this. So the way it looks like it's shaken out is the US Treasury Department has put out a bulletin or guidelines basically saying, you know, we mean it. You will get in trouble for doing this stuff. If you think you might be about to pay some ransoms to a sanctioned entity, get in touch with us first, or we are really going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. So what it feels like they've done is they're going to let Garmin off the hook for this one, but that it's sort of final warning time, right? That's what it feels like to me.
Don't be the next Garmin, I think, is the message here, because, yeah, like, you don't want to have to go and talk to the Treasury Department and ask if you can pay a ransom, and they are basically saying that the, you know, there's a presumption of denial when you go to ask them whether or not it's okay, and if you haven't already talked to law enforcement, they're going to look dimly upon it. And there's just kind of a bunch of, you know, trying to send a message that really what you should be doing is talking to law enforcement and restoring from backups and not paying a bunch of Russians a bunch of money.
Oh, gee, problem solved. That's great. Thanks, Treasury. If only someone else had thought of that earlier.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's aspirational, right?
Yeah, that's a word for it. So, I mean, you know, what happens, right, when the next US company, some, you know, major US brand, some champion of the American economy gets whacked with ransomware and then told that they can't pay. What, the organization goes boom? Like, what well, then? Like, I just don't get how you can seek to apply such a simple rule.
You're right. I mean, there's a complex trade-off between, like, is this business too big to be allowed to fall over? Should they be punished? Like, should it be the free market should extract its vengeance for not having good backups, or, you know, whatever happens to be going on? Or, in fact, you're a victim of a crime? And, yeah, they don't really like the nuanced answer there. And I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how bad it gets. And then it's also, you know, you don't know. It's not like a normal business transaction where you know who you're paying the ransom to, right? You're paying it to some, you know, Bitcoin address or whatever. And how are you supposed to know if they're subject to sanctions? And then the very act of being the sort of person that asks for, you know, that ransoms people probably means you should be subject to sanctions. So, it doesn't seem very workable. But then again, neither does paying ransom. So, I don't know.
Now, basically, the instant we went on break, the United States Department of Justice embraced its, what I'm calling its "fuck all y'all" policy. By indicting, like, a whole bunch of people, right? Like, a whole bunch of Chinese and Iranians, I think. Were there Russians in there as well? It feels like there should be.
There's always Russians.
There's got to be some Russians. Yeah.
There certainly should be if there isn't.
So Brett Winifred wrote it up for our September 22 edition of Seriously Risky Business, our newsletter. If you are not subscribed to that, go to risky.biz, click on the subscribe button on the left-hand side of the screen. You are really missing stuff if you are not subscribing to that newsletter. We do not cover everything that Brett covers in there, and it is certainly top-notch. Work. But yeah, I mean, it feels like they were busy, the DOJ.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of people across, you know, Chinese and Iranian crews, and I mean, you know, the US is clearly trying to make an example of, you know, of some of these people and saying, you know, and especially in the cases where there's a crossover with crime. I mean, that's one of the points that they've been making about some of the Iranian operators, is there is a real crossover with, you know, cryptocurrency theft and other things going on. That means they're not, you know, I guess they don't want to set a precedent where all of the people who work at NSA, TIO also get doxxed by the Chinese, you know, 3 months from now or something. You know, they're trying to, you know, set a norm that, you know, there is more to it than just intelligence gathering. But yeah, they're, you know, this is a change of tactic from a couple of years ago when all of this stuff was very much in the shadows. And now, you know, we've got a whole bunch of mugshots, a whole bunch of people who can't go on holiday anywhere.
It's been going on like that for a while, but it's just, you know, it's just picked up in tempo a little bit. And I think you're right. I think it is about establishing norms. People say, I saw a lot of criticism around these indictments with people saying, oh, well, it hasn't exactly slowed anything down, has it? You know, there's nothing wrong with signaling norms through appropriate application of legal principles, right? Like, that's okay. The Russians who were indicted here, they were just crooks in this case. But you're right, there were a lot of people who were sort of little bit criminal, a little bit spooky. That seems to be where they focused. But, you know, Chinese operators they've indicted in the past have been doing things like IP theft. You know, they tend to not pursue the pure intelligence, like actual intelligence collection, as vigorously, shall we say.
Yeah, and I think that does kind of make sense, because there is, some, I guess, general agreement that you're allowed to do a little bit of spooky stuff. But, yeah, when it comes down to, you know, more economic side of things like the Chinese do, then, yeah, I guess we're trying to set the bar to be a little bit more how we'd like to see things from the Western point of view.
Yeah, that's right. Now, we've got another one here from Wired, this one via Andy Greenberg. I've seen a few outlets carrying this one, actually. Kaspersky turned up a UEFI Trojan, basically, that apparently is linked to a Chinese APT crew who stole it from Hacking Team. Now, one thing that I find really interesting about this, right, is, and we were just talking about this before we started recording, but like basically so many security leaders, right, policymakers, whatever, they don't factor this sort of thing into their assumptions, right? And they should. Like, I'm surprised we aren't seeing more UEFI style stuff in the wild. But here we go. Finally, we've got something in the wild, UEFI malware loader, essentially. And I just think this could cause us a bit of grief in years to come, right?
I mean, it's one of those tricks that, you know, we've known people have been using, but seeing it in the wild, I mean, for example, there was some in the Vault 7, you know, CIA's Vault 7 stuff had some you know, BIOS and early boot malware. But yeah, seeing it actually in the wild, you know, the fact that Hacking Team was selling it, you know, whatever, however many years ago it was that Phineas Fisher took them out, you know, it's always been kind of a niche thing. And if we start to see it in a more widespread way, then, I mean, it's a thing that people don't necessarily think about, and it breaks a bunch of the assumptions that people have during incident response. And it's, you know, can you imagine if the ransomware crews adopted, you know, also trashing the firmware on everyone's machines as well as holding the data the ransom? I mean, that would be, you know, difficult to recover from in ways that recovering from ransomware, if you've got backups, you know, is, you know, if you've got the backups, is relatively straightforward. But if you also then had to deal with your entire fleet doesn't boot anymore, you know, that's going to add an extra level of complexity. So there's always been this kind of, you know, nervous tension that we're going to see, you know, bad BIOSes coming after our stuff. And the fact that it is out there in the wild, I guess people, you know, need to take a little bit more seriously. And the, you know, the pace of secure boot and, you know, secure enclaves and all of the technologies that we've been spending many, many, many years building to be able to try and make this whole boot process a bit more robust, you know, that's still a real patchwork. And, you know, we're going to be worrying about this stuff, you know, for a while.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I read in this piece that just kind of made me shudder is the Kaspersky people are recommending that antivirus companies add UEFI scans into their products. And I'm just like, really? I mean, sure, okay, but like, is that the solution here?
Well, I mean, maybe this is the reason why we don't see it very much, is because no one looks, you know? Maybe there is a whole bunch more widespread.
But kind of comes back to what I was saying about assumptions, right? Like, this stuff could be in quite a few places.
Yeah. Oh, dear. I mean, you know, determining the integrity of all of the firmware on your hardware, I mean, that's a really, really hard problem, right? I mean, we've seen... Yeah, I mean, even just, you know, UEFI is one part. There's so many other bits of embedded microprocessor running God knows what firmware on all of your, you know, all your machines as well. So
it's enough to make you go a little paranoid, wouldn't you say? Much.
Yeah.
Iranian crews, government-linked crews, are now using that absolute horror show domain admin, you know, connect to service, get domain admin bug.
It's been I'm pretty sure everybody who can get their hands on a working, you know, working POC is going to be using that, because what a bug.
Yeah, but there was POC. Like, of course, as soon as I went on holiday, there was POC, right? Like, and but I'm amazed. The world didn't burn down when I was away.
Which is weird.
Well, I mean, you know, UHS burned down. There were a few big stories, but I was expecting that one to get, you know, to sort of raise the earth. But Muddy Water are apparently using it. But we haven't really seen it, have we? We have not seen this bug actually cause that much grief, which is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps there's a couple of reasons for that. Like, one is Microsoft did get ahead of it. Like, they managed to get a workaround out in advance, like by pushing that the patch Tuesday the month before. the workaround didn't really give away the details of the bug, so I don't know how much attention it got back then. Because normally you push a real juicy, you know, bug fix, people are going to reverse the patches, and, you know, makes that time window much shorter. Microsoft had a little bit of lead on this one by virtue of pushing a workaround, so I think that's probably, that's one element. Second is, of course, you know, there's not that many domain controllers, you know, relative to desktops, and keeping those patched, whilst it's difficult to schedule patching for domain controllers, at least there's less of them.
Yeah.
So maybe the, you know, the time window was a little closer, people.
You know, we're totally jinxing it right now. Like, as soon as I finish, like, as soon as I post this show, like,
yeah, it's gonna,
the world will be aflame.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, the quality of the POX has gone up over the, you know, the last couple of weeks as well. Like, the earlier ones are a bit dodge, and that, you know, there was a reasonable chance of causing outages on the domain controllers, other services. You know, the other approaches for exploiting have come up that are a little bit more reliable. And, yeah, I'm surprised that we haven't seen this, you know, really be used widely.
I'm not surprised no one reverse engineered the patch, though, because it's not the sort of thing people are used to looking for in a diff, you know?
It's certainly a weird bug.
Yeah.
And, you know, just super interesting. Like, it's a great bug. And, you know, kudos to the researchers that dug it up, because dang, that's, yeah, proper hack by crypto. That's good.
Azerbaijan and Armenia are going at each other in the real world and in the cybers as well. No surprises there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, I guess we expect this now, right? This is just part of normal conflict, right? Is it going to escalate into the cyber domain as well? And there's been a bunch of reports of attacks, you know, on government systems and, you know, phishing campaigns and all the sorts of things that you would expect, you know, in a conflict like this, which, yeah, it's the new normal.
Yeah, Cisco Talos had a write-up of that has been covered by Sean Lingas at CyberScoop. What else have we got here? North Korea. This is funny. North Korea was trying to hack officials who are on the United Nations Security Council. Adam, you noticed a detail in this story that is quite funny.
So the story talks about the very serious diplomatic attacks and, you know, the fact that the North Koreans will target individuals, you know, across their career in, you know, to try and make sure they get access to wherever these people end up working. And, you know, they'll see targeted campaigns focusing on, you know, on the specific individuals using, you know, for example, using their own names in some of the domain lures and stuff like that. You know, makes it sound, you know, pretty serious and sophisticated and targeted, and, you know, North Koreans, you know, doing important work. And then one of the screenshots, because this was because these campaigns are targeting people who work at the UN, a lot of the lures involve, you know, UN sanctions and things that are relevant. Anyway, one of the emails in the screenshot has the sender UNsanctions@mail.ru.
Totally legitimate email address. Totally legitimate email address. I mean, I just send me binaries from that address. I'm going to run them.
Yeah, sanctions.exe. Like, that's legit as I'm going to run that. But yeah, I mean, you know, I looked at that and I thought, well, you know, I shouldn't judge, right? It's not dumb if it works, but oh God, that's so dumb.
It is. Now here's an interesting thing. Caesar actually dropped an IR report into a breach at a American government department. Looks like it was Fancy Bear who was behind the breach. But yeah, interesting bit of transparency here.
Yeah, so the report kind of talks about the techniques used to break into the organization and then the subsequent kind of lateral movement around the network, but didn't identify who, either, you know, in terms of attribution or the agency that got themselves compromised.
No, but they leave enough in it so that other people could do the attribution bit for them, right?
well, yes.
Because, I mean, if you work at Caesar, you don't want to anger the cheesel by saying the Russia word.
Yeah, so it was very quickly attributed to Fancy Bear. And the, you know, operation's kind of interesting because they went in through, like, obtained passwords which were then used against Microsoft Office 365, and then they pivoted through the O365 into the rest of the network by going and digging up, you know, like VPN, remote access provisioning emails and stuff from inside the cloud environment, and then use that to kind of pivot onwards into the internal, compromise the internal, which is a very modern, you know, much more modern way of doing it, because everyone's using cloud stuff, right? So you have to kind of, often you're going to go in that way. There's also a few other interesting details in the incident response. Like, for example, they eventually mapped a network drive with all of their tools on it, with the idea being, I guess, that when you go to do forensics, the drive just isn't there anymore, which is, you know, it's not sophisticated, but it works. It's one of those things that works quite well. So yeah, some good insights there.
There you go. Microsoft has removed a whole bunch of malicious Azure AD apps that were linked to APT 40. And from this, we deduced that the attacks on the Australian government that had the Prime Minister call a press conference and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it looks like that was APT 40. Brett actually put that one together, so that was cool. Nice score there, Brett.
Yeah, well, that's good to see that kind of loose end tied up, because we were always, you know, a little interested to see who was behind that. But yeah, Microsoft, you know, actually looking into, you know, applications in the Azure ecosystem. That's a point that we've made a few times on the show, and it's good to see them paying a bit of attention there, because the fact that they're actually being used by genuine state actors does suggest they should perhaps tighten up a little bit on exactly how those work.
Yeah, something we may have spoken about once or twice on the show before. What do we got here? Oh, now, remember when the big news was about TikTok and WeChat and that was on the agenda? So, man, you know, so I'm on holiday and I was still paying attention to this, right? Because it was just so weird where the deal that they came up with to make TikTok totally safe and cool and legit was to sell Larry Ellison a minority share in the company. Host it all on Oracle Cloud.
Which improves the security of anything.
That's right. And then job well done. That's it. That was their idea. And it's just basically the deal got announced and then everybody went, what? And then even Trump was like, what? And it all just got really weird. And then a court said, you know, basically delayed the ban. And now no one's talking about it. And I don't know what's going to happen next. That's about as much insight as I can give you on that.
I mean, that's pretty much it. Like, who even knows what's going on anymore? It makes no sense. None of this makes any sense anymore.
And, you know, I mean, everything's so quiet in the US, it's weird that this has dropped off the agenda.
Well, I mean, I'm sure all the TikTok kids are still having a great time, and that's the important thing. But, oh, dear, it's just such a mess, right? And it's very hard to say anything insightful because it really is just a mess, and who knows, right? Who knows?
Yeah, pretty much. I just don't know when the various threads of this thing are going to get picked up and by whom. Like, you know, like this was such a big push and now it's just a mess. It's a mess.
Oh, dear. I mean, maybe Larry Ellison has master plan.
God. The best tweet on it was, you know, Oracle. Congratulations to Oracle Cloud for signing their first customer. I think my joke was, oh, I get it. It's like socialism, but Larry Ellison gets to own the thing. So there were good jokes, but no real movement. I don't know. Crazy. Now, here's one that we actually predicted. So we did that big chat a while ago on ESNI, you know, TLS 1.3 with ESNI and domain over HTTPS, and about how, you know, oppressive regimes were not going to like it. Russia is banning ESNIs. Get the hell off our networks, basically.
Yeah, the Russians have tacked on some language into a bill that's going through the Russian parliamentary process, which I'm sure is going to pass, which is going to seek to have service providers there block HTTPS traffic that they can't reliably at least observe who you're communicating with. And that, of course, yeah, ESNI TLS 1.3 and the related DNS technologies that support that, which, yeah, entirely predictable. They're just not going to tolerate not being able to see and, just block it in the network, I guess, which, yeah. You know, it's part of the arms race that we expected.
Yeah, exactly right. And we're seeing the emergence of possibly two tech spheres. Now, there's another item that I've linked to in this week's show notes, which is an interview with the former Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Not the former Australian Prime Minister who was our guest last week. If you haven't heard that interview with Malcolm Turnbull, do check it out. But Kevin Rudd did a fantastic interview where he talked about China and, you know, the split happening in technology right now, where he's arguing that, you know, this is something that's on, right? This split between China and America. And geez, I was actually surprised by the insight level in his interview. Did you read it, Adam?
Yeah, no, it was a really, really solid read and, you know, explains some of the strategic aspects of it in ways that I hadn't really put together. So, yeah. it was quite insightful. The guy has a lot of experience with China and, you know, plus political experience in the West. And that experience combined does, you know, give him some pretty good insight, I think.
I've dropped that in the show notes. So if you're interested in, because I think that TLS 1.3 ESNI story kind of dovetails nicely with some of the stuff that Rudd was talking about. So do go check that out in this week's show notes. That's one you'll have to read. What else have we got here? Portland, the city of Portland in the United States is banning private sector facial recognition. This is bold stuff and very interesting.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting to see how this plays out because, I mean, there's a bunch of places where facial recognition, you know, is in widespread use. And they've got a couple of carve-outs for those, like, for example, Face ID on your phone. But, you know, there's so many places where, you know, maybe we do see facial recognition being used for things that isn't, that aren't terrible. I don't know what they are, but maybe there are some. Having someone else go through this experiment of what it means to try and, you know, kind of make it by and large just not permitted for anybody to use in any context other than, you know, those couple of exceptions. Yeah, I'm interested to see how this goes because, you know, having some thinking about biometrics and, you know, the very, you know, pervasive use of machine learning to, you know, put a whole bunch of this data together in ways that we didn't think about. Like, that's, you know, a thing that we've criticized, the lack of kind of forward thinking about that. So, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen in Portland, and whether that will embolden other US, you know, jurisdictions to go down the same road, I don't know. But yeah, it's good that someone's trying it, you know, so that we can learn.
Yeah, someone's actually having to think about it, so that's good. A bit of action in the maritime sector at the moment, Adam. We've got a bunch of stories here. We've got three stories here, really. We've got attacks against shipping companies. We've got attacks against the United Nations Maritime Agency, and also a story from CyberScoop saying that the Trump administration is actually looking to bolster maritime cybersecurity practices.
Yeah, the story about one of the big French shipping giants, CMA CGM, which is, you know, one of the kind of big four shipping companies, and it was actually the last of the big four shipping companies that hadn't yet been ransomware, you know, in the last few years. So now that, you know, all of those have been having a lot of trouble, they've been hit by widespread ransomware, you know, in much the same way that we saw Costco or Maersk in the last few years. You know, that's I mean, the impact on global logistics in this case doesn't seem to have been quite as bad as some of the other ones, but it does really underscore, you know, that this industry is both a target and is vulnerable in ways that perhaps some of the other, you know, other industries aren't. I don't know exactly why, you know, why we're saying specifically shipping, whether it's just because the impact is so visible. But yeah, it's certainly interesting to see. And we don't really know, I don't think we know which crew it is yet.
No, and then there's this other attack against the United Nations International Maritime Organization, which does not look like ransomware. So that's, it's just a sector that's going to get a lot of attacks, right? Like, both for ransomware and also for tracking the movement of things. Like, this is something that all sorts of attackers are interested in.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly lots of options. You know, we've seen, you know, what is it like, Somali pirates, you know, tracking ships to figure out which ones they should go and pirate. We've seen, you know, people using it for drug smuggling. We've seen, you know, nation states are interested in tracking, you know, shipments of arms or whatever else. There's just so many reasons to be up in logistics, you know, in the same way that we've seen in the aerospace, you know, passenger aerospace, you know, travel world, you know, keeping an eye on everybody, knowing what's going on. This is the place to be.
Yeah, and I've dropped a link into the CyberScoop story talking about the Trump administration's plans to update US maritime cybersecurity. Let's see if they get it done in the next few weeks, because I'm sure they're going to have heaps of spare time because everything is so calm in America right now. Cryptocurrency exchange breach, fantastic. This one, $150 million. I mean, why do we have legitimate jobs, Adam?
Oh dear, yeah. Now someone hacked this exchange.
It's like taking candy from a really dumb baby.
From the baby's hot wallet. Someone hacked this KU coin, like Singaporean currency exchange, cryptocurrency exchange. Yeah, hoovered a bunch of Bitcoin out. We don't know exactly how. They claim they have enough in the cold wallets to pay people back, I guess. Maybe we are in the wrong business. You know, wait till they fill up the hot wallet and steal it again. That's my advice.
Man, it's just like, you want to make ransomware go away, just nuke the blockchain from space, all of the blockchains, bye-bye. I'm still at that point where I struggle to think what benefit we get from cryptocurrencies.
I mean, you're not wrong.
And I get why governments would allow these things to continue, because they want to see if there's innovation there. And look, I'm sure there are some edge cases where some cool stuff's happened, but is it worth it to have all your hospitals knocked out and people dying? Like, you know, is it worth it? Really?
I mean, certainly if you go back and look at some of the, you know, hyperbole from cryptocurrency enthusiasts, you know, 5, 6, 10 years ago when this stuff started to really rise and they said it was going to reshape, you know, everything. And it hasn't really, you know, reshaped anything except maybe crime. I don't know.
It's crime coins. Like, Bitcoins are crime coins because you use them to buy drugs and you use them for ransoms. That's what they're for.
Oh, and also, you know, you burn a lot of coal to make them. So,
yes,
you know,
that's right. They also have the other effect of destroying the planet. So that's that's wonderful. Anyway, I'm going to get mail from all of the Bitcoiners on that one.
You're totally going to get mail.
GitHub. GitHub are awesome. I love GitHub because they keep introducing new and cool features like this one, Adam.
Yeah, I read this story and I'm like, oh, for God's sake, just leave the bugs alone. Like, how are we supposed to hack anything if you keep doing this? So this is GitHub's rollout, further integration with the CodeQL kind of code scanning tech for security bugs that they bought, I think, a couple of years ago now from SAML. Where basically you can have a whole bunch of CodeQL queries that will run across your code when you check code in, which will check for vulnerabilities. And they've got a set of sample ones, a couple of thousand queries that will spot common flaws in your code. And it will just tell you when you check in a remote code exec bug, which is very rude. And I don't like it.
I'm sure you
I
don't.
I would like to find that bug. Thank you very much.
Man, I'm really impressed. But it's just such a shame, isn't it, that Microsoft ruined GitHub?
Yeah, they ruined all of the open source. But yeah, no, GitHub's just been really nailing it lately for security stuff.
Yeah, for the last couple of years, you know, they've really been going for it. It's really cool. What else we got here? Facebook has sent out the lawyers again, this time targeting the makers of a couple of dodgy Chrome extensions.
Yeah, this is a couple of extensions, one called UpVoice, one called AdsFeed, which claim to, like, I think they give you gift cards in return for installing it and then claim that you're like an influencer or something, and then it just steals all your data and then they sell it as market intelligence. These two are, I think, allegedly the same company, according to Facebook, or the same people involved, according to Facebook. They didn't have a whole bunch of installs. I think it was like 5 and 10,000 installs for the two extensions, but clearly it's worth Facebook's time to go after it, you know, set an example. And Facebook's had quite a history of using, you know, the legal system to go after people who are doing dumb stuff, which, you know, I guess Facebook can do good things, you know.
And staying with browser extensions, you got to worry about the foreigners, Adam. You got to worry about the foreigners making Chrome extensions, according to Senator Ron Wyden.
Yeah, so this was so he put out a release, you know, talking about Chinese or other companies, you know, the countries that are outside of, you know, US spheres of influence controlling Chrome extensions, which of course have been installed in people's browsers and could be used for who knows what. And on the one hand, like, you kind of want to say, oh, come on, really, is that the
but on the other hand
on the other hand, actually browser extensions are terrible and do get abused a lot and are such a natural place to go attack the ecosystem at the moment.
But this seems like such a tangent. You sort of wonder if someone's heard something or if something happened. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just such an odd thing to be specifically concerned about for no reason.
Yeah, like, I think you're probably right. Like, something must have happened. Somewhere someone must have got themselves properly owned, you know, through a browser extension that was either, you know, sourced from somewhere bad or had, you know, had its supply chain be taken over. And, you know, we've seen that happen. But, yeah, there must have been some specific reason why this is. And, you know, whilst it's a little bit, I had mixed feelings about it. On the other hand, you know, there is just very little reason to run a browser extension when you do worry about the security of it, because it's like running a kernel module, right, or running a driver in your kernel. Why would you do that unless you really, really need to? And I don't know that there's a lot of need for it.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And it's the problem here is, right, like, I don't have any trouble running a German extension. Based on it being the country of origin, right? I'd happily run anything from Europe or most of Latin America or the United States, you know, but what are the countries that you're not going to, you know, rely on technology from those countries? It is places like China, places like Russia, right? So, you know, it's one of those things where it comes off, initially you read it and you think it's tub-thumping nationalism, and then you realize it actually kind of makes sense, which is a weird place to be, isn't it?
It is a really weird place to be. And then also, you know, like, I feel a total hypocrite because I'm looking down at my Lenovo going, well, you know, kind of came from China.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do, right? You
different, know? Different. Bad bug in Grindr. This was like an account.
Such a terrible bug.
Yeah, this is like an account hijack bug where basically if you went to reset your password, the web server would leak the password reset token to whoever was, like, so if you knew a user's, like, email address, you would just put it in request a password reset and then, you know, view source and on your way to victory. Just terrible.
Yeah, like, this is a really dumb bug, and I am surprised it took so long for someone to spot this. But yeah, I mean, account takeover on any account you want just by knowing, you know, the email address of a user, like, that's bad in any app. And, you know, Grindr, by virtue of being a, you know, kind of a dating app, yeah, the impact of that is pretty bad, and I'm just surprised that, that no one had spotted this. And good job to the researcher who did find it. There was some kerfuffle, you know, with actually reporting this to Grindr. Like, they didn't really respond very well, and the researcher in question, I think, ended up recruiting Troy Hunt to help him, you know, disclose it in a more effective way, which did eventually work. Troy tweeted, and then all of a sudden, you know, Grindr started paying attention. But yeah, just such a dumb bug.
Yeah, I noticed that you didn't try to pronounce the French guy's name, the researcher who actually found it.
I mean, I've got a French name, and I was going to
try. That's why I found it
French
funny.
Name.
Yeah, so it's Wassim? Wassim Bouamagadin?
Sounds good enough.
Is that close?
Good enough to me.
I don't know. Probably terrible. Yeah,
sorry.
You're probably not listening anyway because you're French. So, you know. Ha ha.
Just eating a baguette, huh?
Who's getting the last laugh? We are. Cool research into Apple's T2 security chip. Someone's essentially found kind of a way to like jailbreak the T2 chip. This is more or less the security enclave chip that Apple ships with its, you know, non-iOS devices.
Yeah, this is an interesting piece of research because, I mean, Apple's one of the few platforms that's kind of, you know, few x86 platforms that's really gone the route of a separate secure enclave. I mean, Intel's got ones that are kind of baked into the existing CPUs and stuff, whereas Apple went, you know, separate chip that's derived from the security chips that they use on the iOS devices. And what's interesting is this is actually an extension of some of the work that the iOS jailbreaking community has done to then, you know, extend this onwards into the T2 chip on desktop, you know, on mainstream, you know, Mac OS computers rather than phones. And this is bad because it's a kind of a, from my reading of it, like basically you can put the T2 chip into like, you know, DFU update mode during boot and then, you know, kind of manipulate its boot process by plugging into the device during boot. And it's kind of difficult to fix because it's kind of a hardware thing. And the net result is code exec on the underlying T2 chip's operating system, which you could then use for, you know, all the sorts of shenanigans you would imagine, being able to steal key material, steal the crypto keys for, you know, full disk crypto, I'm assuming. Plus, of course, you could probably backdoor it and use it for other stuff. So there's a that's not great. On the other hand, Apple's also one of the few companies that's, you know, has built a relatively robust you know, system for doing this kind of trust anchoring on desktop hardware.
Yeah, I'll still take my T2 over whatever the shit is in your Lenovo, right?
Exactly right. I mean, secure boot on, you know, general common garden x86 machine, x64 machines, right, is way harder, right, because the ecosystem is much less mature. So, yes, it's bad. Yes, Apple's going to have to think about, you know, what to do to fix this and to fix it in future machines, but the system is so much worse everywhere else that it's kind of hard to get you know, super upset about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's recent, right? Like this type of tech shipping with desktop computers, like in a you know, meaningful, fully formed way, kind of recent. So you're going to expect this sort of thing to happen. A 14-year-old scored themselves a $25,000 bounty via Instagram.
Yeah, that's some good work. This researcher, Andre Alonso, was looking at Spark AR Studio, which is some Instagram-related, you know, honestly, I don't even know what it does. But anyway, he was looking at it and found what he thought was like an offsite redirect, open redirect bug that Facebook, when they triaged the bug report, decided you could actually leverage up into cross-site scripting on Instagram, which is clearly bad. And they're yeah, paying him out $25,000, which good job.
That's a lot of sherbet.
yeah, exactly. Not bad. 14-year-old kid, good. That's real money for, well, it's real money for me to learn for a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah, I mean, this story also mentions that in 2016, a 10-year-old Finnish schoolboy managed to scoop up a 10K bounty by finding another Instagram bug, an API bug that allowed him to delete comments from any account on Instagram. I don't think I recall that one, but then again, happened in the last 4 years.
Yeah, it's true. Good job as well, I guess. You know, I don't know what a 10-year-old kid does with $10,000, but you know, I'm sure we'll find something.
Mozilla has shut down Firefox Send and the Firefox Notes services. They were both being abused, particularly Firefox Send was being used to send. What do you think? Malware. Catalan had written about that in the past and they'd sort of temporarily suspended it. Then Mozilla went ahead and fired a whole bunch of their staff. And it looks like that feature is not coming back.
Yeah, and I think if you were relying on any non-core Mozilla product at the moment, you should probably have a plan to migrate off it because, I mean, clearly they're refocusing a bit on, you know, the core browser and the few things left that will make them some money.
Yeah. Adam, you remember the Dark Overlord? This was the group that would steal people's info and threaten to release it unless they got paid. You remember the Dark Overlord, the very threatening, shadowy Dark Overlord?
Yes, I do.
Well, Nathan Francis Wyatt, 39, is not a very scary name. Dark Overlord, definitely scarier than Nathan Francis Wyatt. But yes, Nathan Francis Wyatt, 39 years old, has been sentenced to 5 years in prison for his participation in the crimes of the Dark Overlord.
He pled guilty, though, which I guess is at least something. But yeah, facing 5 years in a US jail for a bunch of crimes, including this was the group that went after Netflix and then stole a bunch of episodes or something and dropped them in public, which, you know, I guess that's a thing that's going to get you some attention. But yeah, 5 years in jail after he got extradited to the US. And that, I mean, I guess kind of seems on the low end for American computer crime sentencing. So, I mean, I guess maybe his lawyer did something good.
Yeah, maybe. But it is definitely, you know, the Dark Overlord is definitely a scarier name than Nathan.
Yes,
Nathan. You're going to take a threat from the Dark Overlord much more seriously than from I demand you give me the money.
From
signed, Nathan. Yes, not so much. And the LinkedIn guy, Nicolin, has finally been sentenced to 7 years in prison. You know, this guy's already been in the clink for like 4 years or something. So, yeah, this is the guy who, yeah, owned LinkedIn.
Yeah, on LinkedIn, and he was like arrested in the Czech Republic, and Russia tried to extradite him back to Russia so he could go back to being Russian and be a free person. But no, the US managed to get him to the US first, and it's been quite a long process, by the sound of things, to drag him through through the system.
But again, I mean, like, that's a US sentence as well, 7 years. I mean, look, it's quite a lot, right? But you kind of expect more from the States, don't you?
Yeah, maybe things are starting to normalize a little bit there. I don't know. Or, you know,
we'll
maybe,
say that, yeah. And then next week some kid's going to get the death sentence for, like, doing something really normal. Skateboarding dog this week is actually a skateboarding weirdo. John McAfee has been arrested and charged with a whole bunch of stuff because he was making a whole bunch of money out of promoting these, you know, dodgy ICOs and whatnot. It looks like things are catching up with old John McAfee there.
And it's funny, like, after all of the, well, it's not even funny, I guess, but after all of the things that he's managed to dodge the law over, that, you know, tax avoidance would be the one that gets him. I mean, I guess there's plenty of historical precedent for that, but oh dear, it's just such classic McAfee story. You know, the guy just lurches from one, you know, cock up to another. And, you know, I guess being arrested for something finally is probably good. You know,
yeah.
Keep him out of trouble.
Yeah, probably not a fun time to be John McAfee. And yeah, the alleged rapes and murders were never charged, but this stuff is. It's been weird actually seeing people tweet their reactions to this news, like, ha ha, you know, John McAfee, the wacky uncle of InfoSec. But, you know, as we've said on this show before, like, some of the allegations against this guy, they're not funny, you know?
Yeah, they're really not funny. You know, you kind of want it to be a joke, but yeah, he's kind of a bit beyond that, unfortunately.
Yes, he is. Well, Adam, that's actually it for the news. It's great to be back, and thanks for joining us, and we're going to do it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat, and I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there, checking in to talk through all of the news of the last few weeks. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Scott Kufer of Nucleus Security. Nucleus makes a tool that basically ingests information from vulnerability scanning tools and then normalizes it. And then you can plumb that info through to ticketing solutions or spit it into Slack channels or, you know, really whatever you want to do with it. So think of it like a master console for all of your vuln scanning tech from all of your vuln scanning vendors, right? And when we first spoke to Nucleus, they were all like, yeah, you know, people can use this and they won't have to use spreadsheets to do this anymore. This is a better way. So they're a small startup, but now Nucleus has been around long enough to have gazed into the abyss of quite a few contemporary enterprise computing environments. And what they've seen staring back at them recently isn't just spreadsheets. As Nucleus co-founder Scott Kufer is about to explain, a lot of enterprises are actually trying to create their own vulnerability management software in-house, and 9 times out of 10, it is a complete shit show. So if that's you and your org, keep listening to this interview with Scott Kufer.
As we've kind of grown and we've started to work with some of these bigger customers, we realized that the problems actually are a lot deeper and it's way worse than we ever possibly could have imagined, which is funny and sad at the same time. It seems like nothing has changed in 20 years of vulnerability management, but pretty much every single enterprise that we talk to is developing and maintaining their own internal software on top of the spreadsheets and on top of the 100 people that they're using, that they're outsourcing to other countries to manage and go through all of their data. They're, you know, provisioning anywhere between 5 and 15 developers and, you know, having a 2-year long project and dumping millions of dollars into it before they're just abandoning this. And
I mean, that's the thing, right? Because our whole thing was like, ha, 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 you know, people are doing this with spreadsheets. And it's like, you can't really do it with spreadsheets once it gets to a certain level of complexity. So I guess what you're seeing now is like a whole bunch of internal development to try to crack this problem that you didn't even realize was here.
Yeah, yeah. We developed this internally for ourselves and we just kind of ran with it. And we realized that the problems in vulnerability management were really hard. But we kind of just assumed that some of these bigger enterprises were able to at least solve these problems somewhat. But it turns out that a standard vulnerability management program within a big enterprise consists of Excel, Python scripts, some random databases spread all over, maybe a specific project in place to try to build something that involves maybe collecting data from one or two different sources, and then they give up on it. So it was just, it was mind-blowing for us to basically figure that out. And we were really interested, and we didn't possibly think it was true, right? This was all anecdotal at this point. So we actually did a poll on Twitter to find out what
yes, the most scientific polling method of all.
That's right, man. Hey, you know, you use what you got, right?
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah.
What we found was really interesting. Obviously, statistical significance is but we found out that 82% of people, we got a pretty good response from that too, but 82% of enterprises said that they're developing and maintaining their own internal software to try to solve this problem.
Yeah. And is that something that you've seen? Like, have you actually gone to sell to an organization? They've shown you, well, here's what we are using internally. And it's like, oh God, it's horrible. It's ugly.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, we were very surprised, but I would say most of the time, our biggest competitor is an internal tool. Yeah. So that's the most interesting part about this.
So, I mean, there are companies that offer, I don't think there's anyone who really does quite exactly what you do, but there are other companies that compete sort of with you in this space, right? So like, why are people turning to internal tools when there are actually off the shelf things that can help? What's the rationale there?
Yeah, really, it's that no off-the-shelf tool is going to give an enterprise 100% of what they need, or probably even close to 50% of what they need, right? Every other kind of tool out there that does some sort of data aggregation or vulnerability management services maybe gets you 30 to 40% of the way there, and they just don't work closely enough. I mean, they're further along in their company life cycles that they're not willing to basically work with the clients to continue to develop the product. And so what ends up happening,
so it's like you buy our product and then do it our way, right? Is the vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. And the problem is everybody does it differently. So, you know, no COTS tool is really going to get you there. And that's just the reality is that every other tool kind of solves individual pieces of the problem, but there's nothing gluing it all together. So regardless of any other tool out there, you're still going to be, you know, building your own internal software to try to maintain it.
And to be clear, you're not claiming that Nucleus will come along and just solve all of your problems out of the box, right? Which I got to say, as someone who hears a lot of marketing pitches, it's admirable that you are prepared to say, yeah, you'll need to actually do some work on this once you license it.
Yeah, so our whole approach is that vulnerability management is not a technology problem, right? Vulnerability management on the whole is basically three pillars, right? It's your technology, your processes, and your people. And so we can provide you the technology and you still are required to provide processes and people to solve your actual problems. And so we really view it as a collaborative endeavor, and, you know, we'll get you a lot of the way in terms of the technology, but what really makes us kind of special or unique or whatever you want to call it is that we're working with you to help you structure your processes and people in a way that makes sense. And we're providing the technology as the vehicle to allow you to do that.
It almost sounds like you're pitching it as kind of like a hybrid service, right? Like a, you know, software and service together as a package to come in and establish a program.
It is. It's similar to that. I mean, it definitely is a subscription to the Nucleus software or the Nucleus, you know, vulnerability management solution. But we realized that we just had to do more than just provide you the software and then go away. Our clients just, you're not going to be very successful doing that because everybody does it differently. Everybody wants to know, how are the other clients doing it? How is the rest of the industry, you know, structuring their data? And so we just have to go in and be very helpful and help you build additional capabilities around the Nucleus product.
And have you found that like one customer will ask for a feature and then another customer will ask for the same feature? Like are there some things that you've been asked to develop that it turns out there's sort of universal demand for?
Yes, absolutely. So what we found, and this is really the power of what we're doing, is that vulnerability management and solving the vulnerability management problem is larger than any one company, even ourselves. And so the power of what we're doing is that we're synthesizing the information and the needs of all of these different experts and industry professionals to basically come to the best practices that we should have that basically don't exist at this point. And so it allows us to take all these feature requests and synthesize that down into what are the needs that everybody has and how can we build to solve those needs?
Yeah. Can you give us a concrete example though, of like one thing that you've been asked to add that it turns out had universal, there was universal demand for that?
So number one, marking something as a persistent false positive. So that way, when the same scan comes up and the same vulnerability shows up on the same asset, we want it to continue to be marked as a false positive with the justification with it, with the evidence file from the issue tracker, right? So just being able to not have to do the same work over and over again.
What else?
Automation rules. So when we're looking at changes for all the vulnerability data that comes in, we want to be able to create a ticket to a specific team based on the specific vulnerability type, asset type, or whatever other attributes to automatically create tickets that then are bidirectional in nature and get fed back into Nucleus in real time so that as the tickets are being updated, we get the status reflected back in Nucleus.
Now, look, one area where you guys tell me you are having a lot of success at the moment, as well as bringing on board some sort of, pretty tasty enterprise customers, you're really seeing a lot of growth in MSSP customers, which was always the plan, right? But it feels like this part is actually coming to fruition because you started off as multi-tenancy because the whole idea was, make this usable by MSSPs so they could have individual customer dashboards and stuff. But that's really starting to take off now. Is that right?
It is. We really seem to be a match made in heaven for MSSPs just because of where we come from. We have a heavy background in the services industry, and so we understood their problems innately. And what's really been cool is that we were able to launch an MSSP program or a partnership program where we work with our MSSPs to help them solve the challenges that they're facing as well. So we get to work very closely with service providers, and that's been a really fun journey.
Well, I mean, it makes sense for them, right? Because they don't get to choose what their customers are using in terms of tools, right? So the idea that there's something there that can just plug in, that's, I can understand why it's getting some traction there.
Exactly. Yeah, and it goes back again to that, the way you characterized us all the way at the beginning, working man tool, where we make that efficiency, those efficiency gains are very, very high for MSSPs, maybe even more so than enterprises, because they have the ability to manage all of their clients in one place.
All right, Scott Kufa, the company is Nucleus. People can go check it out. It is interesting stuff, right? Because it is like squarely at the less sexy end of InfoSec where good tooling is really actually needed. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you again, and we'll do it again soon.
Thanks again, Patrick. It's always a pleasure.
That was Scott Kufa of Nucleus Security there, and you can find them at nucleussec.com. Big thanks to Nucleus for supporting Risky.biz, and they'll be back next year with a couple more shows. They'll be sponsoring a couple of shows. And we've got a great sponsor lineup for 2021. We're just finalizing the schedule at the moment. Really good mix of small startups and, big multi-billion dollar companies. We've got everything in between. It's cool. Handpicked for your enjoyment. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back with more security news and analysis soon. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.